Yeah, so my name's Heather Hettinger. I am a Benzie County resident, and I am also the regional fisheries management biologist for the DNR. And by regional, I mean I cover all of the water that drains to Lake Michigan from the Betsy River watershed north to Mackinac. So we kind of manage by watersheds instead of counties and fisheries division, just to kind of keep one person kind of working on the same system. So any inland lake, inland stream, anything that connects to Lake Michigan and near shore areas of Lake Michigan, I'm responsible for managing.
Okay. That sounds like a lot.
It is.
It's a pretty big job.
Yep.
Okay. But to give people maybe a sense of it in terms of counties, it's mm-hmm. six or seven counties, right?
It's actually portions of nine counties. So I have the Betsy dips into Manistee County a little bit. So I have Manistee, Benzie, Leelanau, Grand Traverse, most of Kalkaska, Antrim, Charlevoix, Emmett, and just a smidgen of Otsego.
Wow. Okay. So are you like the head of the biologist for this region?
Sort of. Okay. So we broke the state down into management units. So on the Lake Michigan side, we have the Southern Lake Michigan Management Unit. There's two biologists there. We have, then that's from Muskegon south to the border. We have the Central Lake Michigan Management Unit that I'm in. There's two of us that are managing that. So myself and then my counterpart, Mark Tonello, manages from the Manistee down to just south of the Muskegon.
Okay.
And then we have the Northern Lake Michigan portion, which is basically UP waters. So we have two biologists up there that kind of split from the border back to St. Ignace. So there's essentially six of us on the Michigan side that work that work regionally doing fisheries management.
Okay. So, wow, it just seems like a tiny team.
Yeah.
I have to figure that you have people that aren't necessarily technically biologists, but are data gatherers and researchers of some kind.
So in my crew in particular, I have two technicians, a technician supervisor. We typically have a summer worker. So that's kind of our technical crew. Mark and I also have a supervisor above us. And between the seven of us, like if we're doing lake surveys or if we're doing stream surveys, it's typically all hands on deck. Doesn't necessarily matter like what level you're at. If you're in the unit, you're going out on these surveys to help do data collection. We also have a series of fisheries assistants that work across the state. We have one here in Frankfort. He covers Frankfort, Alberta, and Onekama. It's a job I actually did for 4 or 5 years when I first started with the department. And they are responsible for gathering recreational angler data from folks that fish out in Lake Michigan. So there's a team of us that get the work done.
Do you make policy?
Somewhat. So at my level, I'm responsible for developing or amending fisheries regulations. And fisheries regulations are backed one of two ways. They're either backed in Michigan codified law, so MCLs, or they're backed in fisheries orders, which is an internal policy, essentially.
This is David Decker, angler and co-host. My interest in the fisheries here is selfish, but this is a fascinating fishery that you work in.
It is.
Mm-hmm. I would think not just the difference of the species and the seasons and the planting and the not planting and access, but the human element.
Oh, yeah.
Which is what drives fisheries decisions, typically.
It is. Yeah, it is.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and everybody kind of thinks everything's very biologically driven. And at the core, it very much is. But I do a lot, for a not people-y person, I do a lot more people management than and they don't teach you this when you're doing like your undergrad in fisheries management, right? Like, they're just trying to teach you all the sciencey stuff. And they kind of forget to tell you that you're going to do a whole lot of people management in addition to fish management. So it's kind of an interesting balance. You know, there are some fisheries that you can approach entirely from a biological standpoint because there's not a ton of use, or it's a species that maybe isn't flashy or draws people's attention.
Not on a t-shirt.
Yeah, not on a t-shirt.
Howling at the moon.
Exactly.
With the babies.
Yep. And there's other fisheries where you've got the biological best interest in mind, but there's so much people involvement. You've kind of got to herd the cats and get everybody kind of on the same page, and take people's interests and how they're utilizing the fishery into way more account than you would on other systems. And we have some of those here.
Isn't it fair to say that if there's no human use for a fishery, there's almost no management to be done?
In a lot of cases, you know, some lakes where there's not much human use, maybe they've got a focus species and it's still there because there isn't much human use. So like inland Cisco, thinking about restoring grayling, then those are the kind of systems that we do put some management on because maybe there's a key species in there or a state threatened species that we're trying to make sure it hangs on.
A DNA receptacle.
Yeah.
A safe place for that fish.
Yeah, because there hasn't been much human use.
And maybe some rotenone ahead of time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To clean up.
We're trying not to do rotenone anymore. Yeah. That was a huge thing that we did, 50s and 60s especially.
Yeah.
You know, every lake, this kind of changes. Fish management changes over the decades. But back then, we wanted trout lakes everywhere. We wanted everything to be a trout lake. So we would take tiny little lakes, or sometimes big lakes, and rotenone them, just nuke everything that was living in it, and then stock trout for years and years. And it was a losing battle, because unless you keep up with that rotenone, you know, yellow perch would creep in first, and then maybe someone would bootleg a walleye or two over. Oh, I know it. Hard to believe. Bass would show up, you know, birds move stuff, and it's a losing battle. And rotenone is, well, the only thing we use rotenone for anymore is down around Chicago, the invasive carp fight.
Yeah.
That's pretty much where, and rotenone is in very limited supply in the fisheries world, and that's where the bulk of it goes. The bulk of it that's available annually ends up down there trying to keep invasive carp out.
There's plenty of it on its way to Yellowstone Park.
Yeah, that too.
They have numerous programs there with repeated treatments for the restoration of the Yellowstone cutthroat, as well as grayling in places. Anyway.
Yep. Yep.
So can I touch on the whole people and the fish and whether they matter or not?
Just mm-hmm.
So we have these sturgeon that live in Crystal Lake, and I'm sure other lakes that are, that Torch Lake probably has them.
I've had a couple reports in the past from Torch.
But this lake is not attached to a river that they might appreciate the spawning opportunity in, which is their normal behaviors. They want that.
Mm-hmm.
Like the St. Clair is an example.
Yep.
Big lake, big river. They study them. They know all about them. This waterlocked fish that is in Crystal Lake that can be 70 inches long and 70 years old. Fill us in if you know anything about their life cycle, how many there are. Because as we talked about a minute ago, because it's not something like in the Columbia River where they fish for them.
Right.
And it's a big deal.
Yep.
And a fully guided sturgeon trip on the Columbia River is $1,200.
Yep.
And they catch them and they jump and all this stuff and they let them go. But it's not a fisheries fish per se here, except on a very, very, very limited basis.
Yeah, yep.
So I looked for data on
sturgeon. You mean it's not a sport fish?
No.
Not a fish people here at least are catching on purpose.
Making it no less cool being in the shark family and all that, 30 million years old. So go ahead.
Yeah. So the fish and crystal. So I know of, I've been in this position for 15 years now, I think. And in that time, pretty much every year, I get reports and pictures of at least one sturgeon and crystal. Over the years, I've gotten pictures, the most I've ever gotten is two. So I know at some point in time, there have been at least two individuals in Crystal Lake. Of course, we don't very often hear of people seeing sturgeon in the Betsy. It's not ideal habitat. It's fragmented, right? We've got Homestead Dam. So getting to the prime water if you're a sturgeon, has been inaccessible for a very long time, plus 100 years. But at some point in time, something enticed them when the lake level control structure wasn't there to squiggle up the Crystal Lake outlet and make their way into Crystal Lake.
Post-glacial.
Yeah. Yeah. So and maybe they were helped, you know, and that's kind of the thing. Like, that's a fairly low head barrier. Under high water conditions, it's doubtful that one could make it over there. Somebody certainly could have helped it or helped a couple. You know, and we see that, you know, and with a lot of species, people will pass fish. They hook and line catch a fish and they will pass it over the dam because they know the better spawning habitat is up there. They want to help it along. They think they're doing good. For the most part, they are. But so not 100% certain how those fish got in there. But the logical connection would be that they made it up. And really, if you think about it, the outlet is, it's got better substrate. There's decent gravel through there. There's definitely a lot of sand, and that's become more and more over the years because we manipulate the lake level control structure. That creek, a lot of times, you know, is super, super high in the spring, pretty cold, but come midsummer when we're retaining water in Crystal Lake, it's low, pretty warm at that point. But that's the connection. I mean, that's where a sturgeon would at least try to get up into Crystal Lake. And Crystal Lake has good habitat if you're a sturgeon. It's deep, it's cold, there's abundant forage for a sturgeon. There's a nice combination of hard sand and gravel habitat. So for the most part, they're pretty happy campers in there, aside from the fact that they're stuck and probably not successful at reproducing.
Probably not.
Huh. Okay.
So, but that's the, I guess back to the point, because this fish isn't something we flip a fly at, mm-hmm. or set a downrigger for, the data is like, there isn't a sturgeon in Crystal Lake with a radio in it.
No.
And would that not be cool?
It would be super cool. And I always hope when we survey Crystal Lake, I'm like, man, it would be so cool if we could net one of these. Yeah. We just have never encountered one. We, man, I cannot think of what survey it was last. Maybe it was Hamlin Lake. The crew did a survey in the southern half of our unit 2 years ago and actually in the netting gear collected a young sturgeon that was about 10 or 12 inches long.
A crystal?
No, I think it was Hamlin Lake. I can't remember. It might have been Muskegon. It was one of those two. But that was the first time any of my crew members... and we've all been around. I'm not the youngest on the crew anymore, but I'm pretty close. And I've been here for 15 years. Most of my techs have been plus 25, 30 years. And that's the first time that they've caught one in any of our entrapment gear for a survey. So it'd be great to catch one and pit tag it or telemetry tag it, but just haven't. Yeah.
Off the dock.
I know. And that's the thing. Like if we had a sturgeon specialist, I think, you know, this time of year especially, right, they're cruising the shallows. It's kind of that time of year. People are seeing them when they're putting their docks in, when they're putting their boats and hoists in. That's when we get the most encounters. River anglers are seeing them right now, too. It's shallow. You can see them. So it'd be kind of cool. It'd be kind of easy, I think, you know, to get somebody in here to tag them. But it's not a program we have, unfortunately.
Because we don't fish for them.
A lot of it.
If they were this prize game fish or something, this, you know, this white buffalo.
Yep. And that's kind of the people. And I think one thing people don't realize about the DNR, because I hear this quite a bit, right? Like, why me? I pay my taxes. I fund the DNR. But you don't. We follow what's called the North American Wildlife Model. And most states, with the notable exception of Missouri, follow that model. And so it kind of structures how we're funded. And unfortunately, we're funded on the backs of users. So the only funding that DNR Fisheries Division gets is revenue from license sales. And we get reimbursed by the federal government in DJ funds. So Dingell Johnson Act. And what that does is...
Didn't age well.
No, it really didn't. So what that does is it's an excise tax. When you go buy a boat motor or you go buy...
A fly tire.
Any of those things, anything that you would use as an accessory to fish or hunt. There's one on the hunting end, the Pittman-Robertson Act. That tax comes back to help fund conservation, essentially.
Okay.
So because that's our mainstream funding source, we do pay a lot of attention to what's going to create fisheries, what's going to create angler use, how do we get anglers access to fish, that sort of thing, all kind of is front and center, because anglers are the ones that are funding our efforts.
So they're your constituents, effectively.
Yes, 100%. Okay.
Yep. Interesting. So is that like really in the constitution of priorities? Is
it kind
to
of
serve
is.
Those people?
It kind of okay. is. Yeah. I mean, one of the main goals of my job is to create angling opportunities.
Okay.
But you've got to balance that with also maintaining diverse and robust fish communities.
So going back to the overlap of sociology and psychology mm-hmm. as a fisheries manager,
yeah.
you said herding cats, and mm-hmm. I can totally see how that's the case, at least from like a stakeholder management perspective.
Yep.
Because you have competing priorities of users, right?
Yep.
But it being DNR, of course, your main focus is the game fisherman, mm-hmm. I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to manage, you don't have to manage any commercial stuff, right?
No. So we have an entirely separate division that works with commercial anglers, and we have two sets of commercial anglers. So we have tribal commercial anglers and we have state licensed commercial anglers. And so we have our tribal coordination unit, which is based out of our Charlevoix research station. They're working hand in hand with the tribal commercial anglers. We do a lot of data sharing. All of our tribes have their own individual natural resources departments too. So we do a lot of co-management with them. And then our Lansing office, we have a specialist down in Lansing, and he works, there's very, very few state licensed commercial fishers left. And so he works with those guys specifically.
Okay.
It's just a handful of guys. And I say herding cats, and I mean it in a very good way, because in Michigan, we're fortunate, and this makes things really tough, but it's also very fortunate that we have a really broad angling community. You know, we have guys that spearfish, we have guys that bowfish, we have guys that fly fish, you know, bait fish, lure fish, like, you know, trolling, jigging, casting, like, there are so many ways and means of angling in Michigan.
Jigging.
Like, yeah, yeah, you name it, we can do it here, which is a tremendous opportunity. But it does add another level of dimension when it comes to fisheries management, because sometimes those guys don't get along.
Sure.
So you've got to do what's best for the fish community, and you've got to make sure that you have at least some level of agreement between your angling community too.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Well, and then I guess the other thing I was imagining is also, you know, reminding people like this is our purpose.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like there's lots of interests and mm-hmm. lots of different thoughts about how it should be managed.
Yes.
And you having to be like, yeah, but we have like
yep.
these specific things that we're supposed to be
yes.
doing.
Yes. Yep. And then you throw in, so you've got what I'm trying to do biologically. You've got what Fisheries Division is trying to do to continue to create opportunity for anglers. And then you've kind of got a third level of politics above it.
Yeah.
So every regulation that we make locally has to go through the Natural Resources Commission in Lansing. And then, so you do a lot, especially when you have a very local regulation, you do a lot locally. To work with your stakeholders to make sure that everybody that is directly taking advantage of that fishery has a little skin in the game, has some understanding. And then you put this whole package together and you go to Lansing, and now you've got statewide comments coming in too. And the NRC's kind of got to take those into consideration. So fisheries management is... if I can quote Shrek and Donkey, it's an onion. There's layers.
So you do have to deal with politics, which is unsurprising, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But does it only ever go as high as the state level? Do you have to deal with any federal entities that make your life more complicated?
Not really. We, of course, do co-manage some stuff with the feds. You know, here we've got, you know, locally we've got Sleeping Bear Dunes. So they're state waters, and we have the overlying management responsibilities. But they have some folks that work on fish projects within the park too, so we work with them. In our unit, we've got federal forest land down in the Manistee National Forest. So we're working with U.S. Forest Service. They've got some fisheries staff. that we take out on our surveys with us. And then U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, of course, we do sea lamprey treatments locally on the Betsy and a few other streams. So we're doing a little bit of co-management with those folks as well. But as far as federal policy, for the most part, you know, most fisheries management is done at the state level. There's some Great Lakes stuff where there's oversight, thinking about like lake trout management. Mm-hmm. We essentially have to set the harvest rules and regulations, but the feds raise the lake trout that are stocked. Like lake trout stocking, we hear a lot of times, why don't you guys just cut lake trout stocking? Or why don't you reduce lake trout so we can have more Chinook? That's not really a state decision. That's a federal level decision.
Okay.
So.
Well, yeah, for the Great Lakes, of mm-hmm. course, I guess that makes a lot of sense. And I was curious as well, this following naturally, what happens when it's like something in the middle of Lake Michigan, and so now it's sort of us, sort of Wisconsin.
Oh, good question. So we have, so all the Great Lakes, not just Lake Michigan, but all the Great Lakes have a technical committee. So the Lake Michigan Technical Committee is made up of folks from Michigan DNR, Wisconsin DNR, Indiana, Illinois DNRs, and feds, USGS, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Great Lakes Fish Commission. So when it comes to bigger issues like predator-prey stuff, how many Chinook are we going to stock across Lake Michigan? Those decisions are all made within that technical committee level.
Okay.
So everybody's got some oversight.
Interesting.
Yep.
Well, what are there circumstances where the priorities are dichotomous from one state to the next? Like Wisconsin's decided they don't give a crap about XYZ fish.
Yeah, that does happen. So we've certainly had some disagreements, and it typically has revolved around Chinook salmon. So Chinook are kind of the big players. Everybody, if you're an angler out there, everybody loves Chinook. Everybody wants more Chinook. Pound for pound, they're the biggest fighters. They're the most consistent. So all these fish, with the exception of lake trout, kind of have a seasonality, and even lake trout do to some degree. So there's a seasonality to them. For example, we stock a whole pile of coho in the Platte River. Those fish go to the southern end of the lake in the winter. It's warmer down there. There's more abundant plankton. Used to be all the alewife would flood down there, and it's still a bait fish congregation in the south in the wintertime. And then coho work their way back up the shoreline. So we stock them all up here in order to create that fishery. They're out in front of every port in Lake Michigan on their way home. They end up here in the fall, but every port to the south of us gets a crack at them throughout the year. They're creeping up the Wisconsin shoreline right now. You know, in the wintertime or late winter, early spring, it's East Chicago, Gary, Michigan City, St. Joe, and they work their way up. Chinook kind of do the same thing, except Chinook will kind of hang off in deep water in the wintertime. And so when the near shore temperatures start to warm up in the springtime, every port's got them to some degree in front. And then they kind of follow that same trend when they start to get mature and return home in the fall. So everybody gets super excited about Chinook. Longest opportunity to catch them through the summer. Like I said, pound for pound, they're the hardest fighting sport fish we've got. And that creates some contention because everybody's anglers want more Chinook, more Chinook, more Chinook. We're really fortunate here. The Betsy, in my opinion, has the best production of wild Chinook in the state. The things that make it a marginal trout stream make it a fantastic Chinook producer. So we have a lot of consistency here in Frankfort. That's not the case in other ports. Other ports are heavily dependent upon stocking. Mm. And so you get into this fight. So we have had years in the past where this Wisconsin has kind of decided to go it alone. Mm. So we come to an agreement. This is how many Chinook we're going to stock. This is the predator prey situation. And Wisconsin may stock a few more than what we agree to. So there's really not a great mechanism for, I don't want to say punishment, but for when that happens, there's not a great mechanism for correction. But that's a very rare, that's only happened once or twice.
Would data change or institute a correction? For instance, if the additional stocking that Wisconsin does doesn't bear fruit, mm-hmm. at some point you know, the committee says, well, this isn't changing the math any.
Right.
We're spending X dollars more to put these smolts in, and it's not changing the math, which, yeah. And then the biology of, you know, how much food is there.
Yep. Well, and that's the thing. So we have really great data on Lake Michigan. So USGS and all of our DNRs around the lake work together every year to do a bait fish assessment. So we're tracking, in particular, alewife populations. Everything eats alewife. Chinook in particular are exceptionally fussy. They are like a two-year-old that only wants to eat a hot dog. Like, that's all you're going to feed it, right? They really, really want alewife. It is a desperate situation when you find something like a goby or an emerald shiner in the stomach contents. It happens, but it's typically tied to... Chinook are kind of lazy feeders. They're pelagic, so they suspend in open water. They want their food in front of them. They don't really want to go to the bottom and pluck a goby off to eat it. They're not going to do that. But if we have like a north wind upwelling and a mixing of cold water, and suddenly there's some suspended gobies, which never are very far from the bottom, but maybe you've got Chinook closer to the bottom because it's cooler down there. You've got a few gobies up and off the bottom. Then they're going to eat them. Same thing with smelt. There's, you know, when smelt are in front of them, they will eat them. Smelt aren't always in front of them, and they're not going to chase them down. So we track alewife numbers very closely, and that all goes into the decision-making. So we have this red flag system set up where there's a number of parameters, and if we trip one of these parameters or raise a red flag, we cut stocking. And so there have been years where we have, for the most part, when we trip a red flag and the red flag system tells us to cut, everybody cuts. There, where the conflict has been is there's been a few years where we were exceptionally close to tripping a red flag. So one of them is that the weight of female Chinook salmon returning to the weir is, I think it's 16 pounds, the average. And let's say we're at 16.2 pounds. And the rest of us are like, we should make a little reduction. That's kind of where the situation has been, where maybe Wisconsin or somebody else has diverged from that.
Okay. That seems like such a small difference.
Right, right. I know. So you're like, man, we should err on the side of caution. But it's a constituent thing.
You take overweight females as a bad sign.
No, underweight females.
Underweight, okay.
Yeah, underweight females. So it's a condition factor, essentially.
That makes sense. Yep. All right.
Yep. And there's other parameters,
and
too.
And the main connection being if there's too many Chinook, then all of them are starving a little.
And that is kind of... So what we see, what we don't want to see, it's kind of weird. We don't want to see huge numbers of Chinook with a low average size.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So what you've got there is you've got numbers are good, which everybody likes, but their condition factor is starting to dwindle.
The lemming problem.
Yep. So you can have, that leads to issues with reproductive success, and it's an indicator that your bait fish community is not very strong, at least when it comes to alewife. So we prefer to see moderate numbers of Chinook with a higher average size.
Okay. It's just fascinating to me that everything seems to just boil backwards from a fish people care about.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly fishing.
Yep.
Right? And then it's like, okay, well, let's figure out all the biology and ecosystem data that has to do with that fish.
Yep.
So here's a data point that focuses on what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
We just did the Crystal Lake Watershed Association walkabout.
Yeah, yep.
With the boat check. I'm the angler in company, so nice. I get to do that part of the invasive species conversation. And we talk about the difference between invasive species and exotic species,
mm-hmm.
and it has to do with what they do to us.
Yep.
Right? Apples, cherries, honeybees, and now alewives
mm-hmm.
are an exotic species
totally.
And not considered this horrible invasive species. But as a child here, I remember the D9 bulldozers on the beach.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
And the pyres of smoldering alewives, 15 feet high and 100 feet long,
mm-hmm.
and there were several years in a row where going to particularly the Alberta beach, it was, I think they roped it off. It was, so you have this, all of a sudden here's this fish everybody hates,
mm-hmm.
and now it's the it's on the chessboard, it's the queen.
Right, we're doing everything we can to maintain.
So an exotic species or an invasive species can transition in some rare instances to being this is the fisheries version of the cherry tree.
And gobies have gone a little bit that direction too. I was at a Torch Lake meeting last week and I made the comment that gobies right now are my favorite invasive.
Everybody pick your favorite.
Exotic.
Yeah, exotic now, right? So, because everything, a lot of things, have adapted to utilizing them.
Sure.
And it's changed the game in a positive way. You know, we talk a lot about lake trout, and there is a love-hate relationship in Great Lakes anglers with lake trout. So they are our native species out there, you know. Back before alewife and rainbow smelt and Chinook and coho salmon, we had cisco, whitefish, and lake trout. And the invasive lamprey.
And pike.
Pike and walleye, muskie. The invasive sea lamprey in commercial fishing did a number on lake trout. Like, they were on the verge of being gone. And so, you know, the feds and the states have done a lot by the means of sea lamprey control, and we have a lake trout restoration plan to bring those fish back from the brink. The last piece that was holding them back is alewife. So if you're a lake trout and you eat alewife, and lake trout will eat anything, they're gluttonous, but everything loves alewife. Everything will pluck alewife out. Yeah, because they live in these huge balls. They're a schooling fish. They're easy pickings, and they're
chicken fingers.
Yeah,
floating through the sea.
Basically,
they're oily.
And yeah. So, but what if you're a lake trout and you consume a lot of alewife? What that does is it creates a thiamine deficiency.
Oh.
And what it's a long and connected thing, but that thiamine deficiency leads to a reduction in reproductive success. And it hasn't been until alewife numbers have been on the decline and goby numbers were on the incline and lake trout started focusing on gobies that changed.
Interesting.
So, and it changed for us too. You know, you'll hear old timers that are like, they call them greasers, right? Nobody wants to eat a lake trout. They're greasy. Yeah. They're greasy. They're gross. I love lake trout.
Goby fed.
So gobies are full of protein. They're little vitamin B bombs. And so for a lake trout, if you're consuming that, you're not processing all that oily, greasy saltwater fish that is an alewife. And you're putting all this into muscle tissue. It's nutritionally better. It doesn't create that thiamine deficiency. So we're actually, in the past 10 years, we've seen an increase in lake trout natural reproduction, particularly in the southern end of the lake, that is tied to gobies being a large component of the diet.
Awesome.
And anglers are more likely to consume them now too because they taste better.
That sounds like a good, almost a fairy tale.
Yeah. So hence why gobies are kind. And smallmouth eat them, walleye eat them, brown trout eat them. There's a lot of stuff that eats them. So.
So for Central Michigan, which is us here in Benzie County. Yep. So. We've been talking about relevant conversations. I forgot, actually, the first thing I usually do is say, well, how do you find yourself in Michigan? Maybe we'll call it the Central Michigan area. Normally, I'd say Benzie County.
Yeah,
but...
nope. So I grew up in northern Kent County in a little farm town just north of Grand Rapids. And when both of my grandfathers got back from World War II, my maternal grandfather bought a cabin on the Little Manistee, and my paternal grandfather bought a cabin on Wolf Lake down in Lake County. They were best buddies, and so I think when my mom and her sister were probably 10, 11, 12, that side of my family built a cabin like a quarter mile down the lake from my paternal side of the family. So my entire family, my entire childhood was spent coming up to Lake County every weekend to go fishing and hunting and hiking and do whatever here. So I always knew that I wanted to work for the DNR. I didn't know which branch of the DNR I really wanted to go into, law, fish, wildlife. So as soon as I graduated from high school, I started working for the DNR, of course, all through college. And I had intended on ending up, we used to have a DNR office, a fisheries office in Comstock Park, which was pretty close to where I grew up. And I had always intended on working out of that office when I got hired. And the year I finished my undergrad degree, we closed that office. So that kind of went down in a ball of flames. And I got hired to be the creel clerk here in Frankfort, in Onakama. So I worked as the creel clerk here for, I think, 5 seasons and really kind of grew to love the area. And so went on to finish my master's, met a former charter boat captain here that I ended up marrying. And so just decided I wanted to stay in this area. I think, so there's 14 of us across the state. There are 14 fisheries management biologists across the state. And I think out of those 14, I have the best water. I mean, I've got stuff like, well, this stretch of Lake Michigan, right? We have the best shoreline up here. Sleeping Bear, the islands. I get to manage the Beaver Island Archipelago. Like, I manage lakes on an island. How cool is that? I get to go out there a couple times a year. Best shoreline with Sleeping Bear Dunes. We have Crystal Lake. I do Torch and Elk Lake. I've got some amazing little, tiny little inland lakes. I've got river systems that are great fisheries, but not super, super popular fisheries. So I feel like I have the best region of everybody in the state.
Super popular. I can see what you mean, that if it's a, yeah.
It gets to be a little much.
I'm a little jelly. I can say that right out loud. Kind of
Well, actually, it's kind of an interesting thing that's just popped into my head. I've decided it's interesting.
Okay.
Which is like, well, so there is, of course, the sociology management stuff, which is like, put in here, take out here, this is how many you can keep, this is the slot limit, all that stuff. So you would necessarily be kind of interacting with FWP, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so to what extent are you involved in like managing, in regulations, managing people that aren't necessarily directly related to specific species of fish, I guess is the question. Like X number of people per stretch of river type stuff like
that.
Yeah.
So that gets a little difficult. And it, so especially with when you think about rivers and stretches, my river, the rivers that I work on don't necessarily have, and this is a good thing, right? I don't have so many stretches of river that have like different hook regulations or different keep regulations, because I don't have a lot of fragmentation in my rivers. I don't have, you know, the Betsy has, at this day and age, the Betsy has one dam. And we have a very clear transition line, like at Curick Road. That's our transition line between a type 1, which is the more protected stream type, and a type 4, which is open year round. But I don't necessarily have a river with a bunch of dams that create different transitional zones that really kind of require that extra level of additional regulations. For the most part, my river sections are pretty intact. The Boardman was the most fragmented river system I had. And the Boardman is so stinking cold that we never got to the point where we really needed to look at those different regulation types in order to maintain fisheries populations. They recovered from those impoundments really quickly.
Mm.
So you had different regulations in the impoundment because it was, you know, essentially a lake. But as far as the river sections go, once you got away from that thermal impact, they were all very similar. We didn't need a regulation that would necessarily add an extra level of protection because things got back to kind of quote unquote normal quickly. So I'm pretty fortunate in that I have some rivers that have like single hook only restrictions. And a lot of that has to do with water clarity and trying to correct angler behavior. If you have gin clear streams, so I have a single hook regulation on the Platte year round and the Bear River up by Petoskey, both of which, and the Jordan River. Those are all systems that are gin clear. And we have historically had issues with snagging, especially when it comes to Chinook.
Mm.
Flossing,
yes. Well, and in some cases, it's not necessarily flossing, but you've got guys that'll tie a piece of yarn on a treble and just drag it. And some people are trying to fish that way somewhat legit. But there are some guys that are just throwing and trying to grab. And that's the behavior that we don't want to see. Snagging was legal in Michigan for a few years, and it put a bad taste in, and we haven't quite gotten rid of that bad taste yet. And some people have the mentality of, oh, you know, these Chinook are going to come up and spawn and die, so who cares? But it's the integrity of the sport, right? It's facilitating good angler behavior, you know, pointing out the need for conservation. Yes. Are they going to go up there and spawn and die? Totally. But that's part of the deal. We want them to do that. You know, we want them to go up and reap, especially in the Betsy, where we get a ton of natural reproduction. We want them to go up into the upper sections of the river. That's why it's closed at the end of September. We want them to go up there, spawn, die, contribute nutrients to the ecosystem. Like, we don't want them just taken out. Sure, we want some fish harvested, don't get me wrong, but we want some fish to go up there and spawn and contribute back to the ecosystem and provide some nutrient loading. So even though those fish are just going to go spawn and die, you still need to be respectful of them and be respectful of the sport.
Well, that's interesting, because there's several sets of reasoning there that really don't have a whole lot to do with each other, right?
Right.
Like the ecosystem
right.
part of it, that's natural sciences.
Yeah. Yep.
And it makes sense that you don't want to be just constantly extracting tons of nutrients from the system.
Yep.
And then there's the, like, I guess this maybe comes back to your stakeholders. If the majority of the people who fill the coffers of the DNR by buying fishing licenses, if most of them say, yeah, we're against this, then so it's a democratic process in its own right. Okay.
Yeah. And when you talk to anglers, the majority of other anglers don't appreciate seeing that kind of behavior. Like, they're coming up here for a little peace and relaxation. They want to harvest a salmon or two. They want to have a good experience. They want to teach their kids how to fish. You know, they're up here for relaxation. And they don't necessarily want to be around that kind of behavior either.
Yeah. It's not as bad as a quarter stick of dynamite.
Well, no.
The gallon bleach bottle in the little Manistee below the railroad bridge in Irons with the screwdriver hole in it. And I witnessed that as a child. My grandpa had a place right there.
Okay.
Just below the Indian Club.
Yep.
And I grew up fishing there. And I witnessed an evening where the locals had decided it was time to fill the barrel with the steelhead in the log jam. Yeah. So the other thing that you see happening, and we saw this in Montana with respect to bait fishing versus fly fishing and the whole idea of catch and release, which is...
And treble hooks.
And the hook regulations. Yeah. But what happened after a period of time, and where we worked and lived was near Butte, Montana, where if it bled, it died.
Yeah.
And in a period of maybe 10 years, because of some conservation efforts and conversations and people realizing that you can't keep all your fish in a river and expect them to be there if you want wild fish. I mean, if you don't mind the truck full of fish. And over a period of 10 years, the Butte Trout Unlimited and whatnot, talking about putting the fish back, the Butte angling community, blue collar, we're going to eat them, are the most vehement lions about putting fish back in the river all on its own.
Yep.
And so you have a slot limit, but the slot limit is just completely ignored. No one, professionally or otherwise, are keeping any of those fish. And so, like, on the Platte, when the cohos are in and there's this thing below the weir that happens, if there's one guy out there and he's casting and jerking, the other anglers, and I've watched this happen, I don't fish there, but I've watched a few times, like watching golf, sort of, they make it plain that this behavior, it not only is it illegal, we don't like it. And you need to go back, first of all, put a shirt on. I probably shouldn't say stuff like that on the radio, but it's a sportsman that isn't.
Yep.
And it's an angler that isn't. And if you want to get them, use a net. But that societal adjustment through education and just caring for the resource and appreciating the angling for what it is, it has a tendency to sort of self-sociologically police itself.
Yeah.
And you see that.
And we like that.
And
like,
it's efforts that start, though, with the DNR and people who are in conservation organizations, like anybody who's talking about these fish and how and why and how special they are. Mm-hmm. This isn't special.
No, absolutely not. And we like peer pressure. Like, we like angler. Nobody wants to have to write you a ticket for your crappy behavior. Contrary to popular belief, our COs don't really like enjoy writing tickets, and we don't make any money off of them. That's a whole other.
We know one of those, don't we, Pierce? Yeah. The chief, Alan Marble. Do you know?
Yeah, I know Alan. Yep. Yeah. So yeah, they don't. Those guys don't really want to write tickets. We don't get rich. You know, if you get a ticket and it's $100. 80 of that's going back to the county. It's just fees. We're not getting rich. Sorry to break that bubble. But, we like anglers to police themselves. And I hear this all the time. Well, you know, they're not going to bite. We should just snag them anyways. They're not going to bite. I fish the Platte a bunch in the fall, and I'm here to tell you they will bite. Are you lining some fish? Sure, just because of the sheer volume of fish in there. You get in there first thing in the morning and work a small group of fish and again, it's gin clear. You know, you cast a spawn bag on a tiny spawn bag on a number 10 hook and let it roll through, through the outside edge of a hole. And I'm watching salmon come out and pick it up because they're curious or because they're pissed off. Like, there's reactionary strikes. So this whole, I'm going to rip on them because they don't bite thing. Not buying it. But, sure, at some point they're not going to, but there's plenty of fishable time on those salmon too. So we like when anglers work together to correct that bad behavior and use peer pressure to drive the non-sporting folks out.
Non-sporting. Mm-hmm. In Montana, there was sometimes conflicts between the pros, the guides, guides and outfitters versus just the fun floaters or weekenders or whatever complimentary or derogatory terms you want to use. But Montana was weird because of how, pretty strict the outfitting rules are.
Yep.
Like, you can't just go guide somebody.
Yep.
Whereas I think in Michigan, that's not the case, right? You don't have
getting better. So historically, you had to have two things. You had to have an inland pilot's license if you did not have a Coast Guard tonnage license. So you had to have one or the other. And then if you were using state access sites to run trips off of, you needed a state land use permit. But the enforcement of that was not super strong, and it really wasn't telling us anything. So 2 years ago, this is the second full year, we started an inland guide requirement. And so if you are guiding in Michigan, whether you're ice fishing, fishing on a pier, taking someone in a drift boat or a canoe down a river, or fishing out of your bass boat on Crystal or Glen, if you're taking clients for money, you need to be a registered inland guide. It's $150. It's a 3-year license. If you have your Coast Guard tonnage license, you don't pay the $150. And there is a reporting requirement. So at the end of every month, you have to report to, and the Great Lakes Charter Boat guys have been doing this for decades. So it's not really anything new. And there's a lot of overlap between river guides and Great Lakes Charter guides.
Sure.
So the actual, like, new people that are getting into this system, it's a smaller fraction.
And the reporting is who did you take?
Where
did you
take them? How many people did you take? Which water body did you fish? How many hours did you fish them? What did you release? What did you harvest?
Okay. A
couple other demographic things. Zip code, how far did you travel, age, all that good stuff.
Data.
Yeah, data. And so we only have 1 year's worth of data. So fairly preliminary. We're not sharing it. It is somewhat shareable. We're not blowing up anybody's hotspots. We tried to keep it very 1,000-foot level.
Do they provide this digitally to you?
Yes.
You give them a form, they tap it in.
There's an app for
it.
Yep. So pretty easy.
And it comes to you usable.
Yes.
It isn't a bunch of chicken scratchings on gut-covered tablets.
And we've been doing this Great Lakes Creel program and the charter boat reporting for decades, at least 30 that I can think of. I think it was the late 80s that we started it. So pushing 40 at this point. So that's been refined over the years to a pretty easy to use system. And so to simply bring the river guides over that weren't in it already it's been a fairly easy transition. And so we have about, I think it was 560 some. Oh, don't quote me on that. Maybe it was only 300. Anyway, less than 1,000 people are registered guides in the state of Michigan.
Wow.
Which is something we didn't know even prior to this. So.
And you're getting a ton of information.
We are.
Usable, helpful.
Yep.
It's organized, digital.
Yep. Whereas
numbers.
In the past, this would be all anecdotal, right? Like I would call you up or you would call me up and be like, hey, you know, this
survey.
Is what I saw. Yeah. Just, we have a fair number of guides around here that I have pretty good relationships with. I've known them for a long time. So I'm getting anecdotal information from them. But now I've got their anecdotal information and I've got some data that we can do statistical analysis on to help that. So I'm getting information from two directions now to help make decisions.
Cool.
Yep.
What are your main concerns in the moment? Like I guess maybe the two or three biggest things that the central Michigan fisheries are worried about.
One thing in particular, so I have a lot of deep cold lakes, Crystal, Glen, Leelanau, Elk, Torch, that have all historically had Cisco and whitefish populations. They now all have Dracenid mussels as well. So zebra, mostly zebra mussels, and we're starting to see, or we have found quagga mussels in a lot of these deeper lakes too. And we're seeing a concerning trend in whitefish. So I was looking at the Torch Lake data the other day. We caught 103 whitefish in the most recent survey that we did in 2018, which sounds great. Like, hey, that's a pretty good number of whitefish for a week-long effort. They were all 11 to 14 years old.
Oh.
Yeah.
Missing.
So one of the tribal natural resources came in the fall of that same year. They're like, hey, they do a little bit better job of targeted coregonid netting, so looking specifically for Cisco and whitefish. And they came in the fall and said, well, we'll come in and do a targeted effort and see, you know, see if we can find some broader age groups. And they did not either. Hmm. So what we've seen in Lake Michigan is there's been a correlation between the arrival of the Dracenid mussels. And of course we know what they do, right? They filter feed. They can filter a liter of water a day. And when they filter that liter of water a day, they're essentially sucking everything out of it. Every last piece of plankton, zooplankton. And they have essentially locked up the majority of the energy in Lake Michigan. Because they consume it, they use it, they die, they're hanging out on the bottom. It takes a very long time for one of those shells to break down. And in the interim, all those nutrients are just locked up on the bottom of Lake Michigan and not available for anything else. It's not like a fish carcass that, you know, they use up those nutrients, it dies, beats around on shore, ends up out in the deeper water, crayfish eat it, microbes eat, everything eats it, and it's back in circulation. You don't get that with the mussels. And so we've seen a significant decline in productivity in Lake Michigan. It's been really hurtful. We see it the most, right, because we are seeing declines in forage fish numbers, whether that's smelt, emerald shiners, bloater chubs,
alewife.
Yep. It's also really hurting those coregonids, especially whitefish. Cisco have managed to keep up with the times, and Cisco have incorporated other fish into their diet a lot more heavily.
Is there anything that eats the mussel?
So gobies are a natural predator.
Okay.
But we don't have enough gobies. We got a lot of gobies, right? The gobies are not keeping up with the mussels.
Wow.
And so what we're seeing is when you're a whitefish and you rely on the bottom level of the food web to grow to be 10 pounds, to grow to be 10 to 15 years old, you're in a world of hurt right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing that. We saw it in Lake Michigan first. And we're seeing it in our inland lakes now. Now that they've all had zebra and quagga mussels for, you know, looking at 10, 20 years. I saw a talk. There's a researcher that works out of the Annis Water Institute. She gave a talk at a meeting that I did last week. And she showed a really interesting graph. And it was pictures of Lake Michigan that showed mussel infestation. So the top set of images was zebra mussels and the bottom set was quaggas. And so in Lake Michigan, the zebra mussels are almost undetectable at this point. Like if she goes out and takes a sample and it's 1,000 mussels, there's one of them that's a zebra.
Have you noticed the shells on the beaches in places of the zebras that have perished?
Yeah. Yep.
Like
it's like the yellowhife.
Yards of
it. Yeah, it's like the yellowhife in the 60s.
So is that because they're being outcompeted?
Correct. So they have used and these mussels are kind of depth limited. So zebra mussels really like shallower water. They also need something hard to attach to. Mm-hmm. Quaggas do not. They're a little more open in bottom types, and they don't need anything to attach to.
Okay.
So they're being more successful out in deep water areas. The zebra mussels have eaten themselves out of house and home in these nearshore areas. So they've plateaued and are falling off. And quagga mussels it looks like they've kind of finally hit their plateau. And this is what all invasives do. Doesn't matter. Invasives are boom and bust.
Sure.
They come into somewhere, there's an open door. They go crazy because there's an open niche for them. Mm-hmm. And then at some point in time, they will find a plateau. Typically, they plateau and we're kind of always stuck with them at some baseline level. Sometimes they fall off completely, which appears to be what zebras have done. Quaggas are still in the plateau. So the quaggas are actually our dominant muscle out there right now.
Let me do the station ID. It's been a little too long here. This is WUWU LPFM 100.1 Frankfort, Alberta. Thank you so much for tuning in. We are talking to Heather Hettinger, who is a fisheries management biologist for Central Michigan. She's a big deal, knows all kinds of stuff. And she, if you enjoy fishing, she should be your best friend. Because she makes sure that your access to catch those fish is
there,
maximized and well-managed.
Opportunity is the word we love.
It is. Yes. Yep. We like angler opportunity.
So, yeah, we were talking about present issues from the DNR's perspective about your fishery.
Yeah.
Fisheries.
Yep. Fisheries, yeah.
Okay, so quagga mussels.
Yep.
But you're hopeful that the ecosystem is just going to rebalance.
We hope. We're seeing some interesting patterns. We just came off of a high water cycle. You know, we had high water from about 2016 to 2021-ish, and what we saw there was what we think we're seeing is a little bit of a response, particularly in Lake Michigan, to increased nutrients coming off the landscape. Unfortunately, right now we're kind of in a low water cycle. This is going to be an exceptionally low year. You know, we're already seeing it. If you look at Betsy Bay behind us, it's 3 or 4 feet lower than it was this time last year. And that's probably going to be the trend through the end of this year. High water does really good things for the ecosystem. You know, it draws nitrogen and phosphorus off the landscape. You've got more of a terrestrial interface with water. It's good for bugs. It's good for critters. Creates wetlands or replenishes wetlands and allows them to sustain through a low water cycle. So with that high water cycle, we think we're seeing some pretty positive improvements. But then who knows how long this low water cycle is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Our last one, they typically are 7 to 10 years. So, you know, we're probably 3 or 4 years into this one. So hopefully we can get a rebound. We had a super great winter, right? We had a ton of snow. It was, air quotes, normal. But Lake Michigan didn't freeze. It was a lot of lake effect. In order to really gain water, we need system snow out of Canada. We didn't really see that. A couple minor systems. So despite the fact that we had a pretty normal winter as far as snowpack and melt.
That was just water pulled out of Lake Michigan to flow right back into it. Okay.
Yeah, so.
I never thought of that problem.
Evaporative.
Yeah, evaporative. So isn't really going to help us out too much. We need a pretty good hard winter. And that was what we saw in 2014, right? And that's kind of what boosted us into this last high water cycle. You know, we were virtually drought conditions in 2013, 2014. We closed the mouth of Betsy Bay to fishing in 2013. And then 2014, if you remember, was the worst winter we had in a decade. We were out of power for 3 or 4 days. We had 300, it was a lot of snow. So
that was the polar vortex winter.
Yeah.
I remember
that. That was what jump-started this last high water cycle. So unfortunately, we need a really bad winter, bad by our human standards, to kind of help get things going again. So low water this year, declines in whitefish populations, whether it's inland or Lake Michigan. We see that a little bit in perch, too. We saw that perch response to Dracenid mussels. I feel like perch are doing a little bit better, especially in our inland lakes. those are some pretty big issues. And then for us, the overlying issue is always alewife numbers in Lake Michigan.
Mm. Yeah. So the Crystal Lake Watershed Association at least suspects that there may be quaggas in Crystal Lake. Would that surprise you or not?
No. So I had a good conversation with John Ransom about this last year, actually. So they did some eDNA analysis and had a hit. So John called asking if he could borrow some equipment to do some bottom grabs to see if we could collect any. So he's got a grab net of mine that he's been using to get some samples with. We've seen the same. So this is the same thing. Torch is seeing the same thing. Elk is seeing the same thing. I think they haven't really looked in Glen or North Lake Leelanau, but again, not surprising. These bodies of water that we've got around here that are inland and can get to 100 plus feet of water, the natural transition has been you get the zebras first, they do their deal, and the quaggas come in and kind of once the zebras are tailing off. And that's what we're seeing in inland lakes too. Everybody's like, oh man, you know, the zebra mussels, I'm not seeing them on my dock as much. We're still seeing shells, we're still seeing fish, or we're still seeing mussels out deep. And so it's not entirely surprising that we're getting some quaggas in these systems as well.
And the quaggas and the zebra mussels arrive in boats and on trailers.
Correct.
And
correct.
On...
What about seagull poop?
Yeah.
Not necessarily seagull poop. Where you see the movement in these mussels is when they're veligers. So when they're very, very young, when they first hatch, they have this, it's called a veliger stage, where they can swim. They're not swim.
Larval.
They're mobile. And that's where they end up, you know, you fill your bilge for the day. Let's say you salmon fish in Lake Michigan, you fill your bilge for the day. You've got these veligers in your water. You drain it, but there's still a little sloshing in the bottom. And the next day you go to Crystal and you start catching rock bass and you're like, oh man, I'm gonna keep these. And so you fill your bilge again, or your live well again, I mean. And then at the end of the day, you're at Mullineaux Road and you're draining your live well, and here you're just washing it right back into Crystal. So inadvertently for years, we've been moving these things around, and people are much better. We've had a pretty lengthy campaign about, you know, drain, dry, treat, you know, your bilge, your bunks, your live wells. The Crystal Lake Boat Wash Station has been awesome. Glen Lake has been washing people's boats for almost, man, over 30 years, I think, now. And they were pretty much the last lake to get everything. They got it all in the end.
It's like chicken pox or
a
something.
A little bit,
but you
yeah.
can't make people go to the boat wash. No. And
they do up there, though, man. They, if you sneak past those folks.
Yeah, we live over there. Are we? Yeah, they're good at it.
But they have a captive audience.
Drive by Ed Hoopdirk and not wash your boat.
See what
happens. Yeah. You're going to jail.
I'll chase you down, which I appreciate.
But it only takes one, and it can be the bilge. It can be the live well. It can be the anchor rope.
Yep.
It can be in Montana and Idaho and Wyoming. You drive from river to river, and you go by a check station with a boat, kayak, inner tube, and you don't stop. They come get you.
Oh yeah.
And you get a little clip, and it certifies that your boat is clean or not.
Yep.
And they have these high pressure, high heat cleaning stations all over these states.
Yep.
And we're not at the mandatory phase, and a boat wash station is expensive.
They are.
You have
they
to
are.
Man it. It has to be shut down in the winter for because it has water.
The heated water is super important. So now you've got propane or electric bills associated. And,
And then you have to, even if you have it, you can't make someone. I mean, if you drive down to the Beulah fishing access where the boat wash station is at 4:30 in the morning to put in the dawn. Well, there's no one there.
No.
And if you have to choose to drain, dry, clean, everything, and that's what we try to teach these sixth graders at the walkabout.
Yep.
Go home, tell your pop it's important to whatever, clean the boat. But if everyone doesn't do it, I mean, how many quagga larvae are in a cup of water?
A bunch.
Potentially. And your motor. Outboard motor, there's always two cups of water left inside it. You start it up, the water pump turns on, game over.
Yep.
So what I'm getting at in the end of this is that it isn't if
it's one?
The quagga will be in Crystal Lake and all the other lakes. Yeah. It's when and who will make the deposit.
Yeah.
And what damage will it do?
Yeah. And I suspect they're in all of them at this point.
Yeah, I agree.
Where is the DNR at the moment in terms of the philosophy of using, like, biological counters?
So, we prefer it. I'm having this conversation with a few local lake associations right now about aquatic vegetation. After decades of treating nuisance vegetation, so things like Eurasian water milfoil, that's a big one. Not so much Phragmites, but Eurasian water milfoil is a big one. When it's chemically treated, there's collateral damage. So native species that may grow intertwined with the EWM, things like coontail or native milfoil species, you see a decline in those inadvertently. And so we're seeing some changes in fish communities. We're seeing some changes in habitat that are concerning. And we've got, for a long time when it came to EWM, there was a company in Indiana, I believe, that was raising a species of weevil. And so they would stock these weevils in these lakes, and they would slowly but surely eat through the invasive milfoil. Very expensive. And it just wasn't working. And so they, to my knowledge, they no longer do that, which is a bummer. There was the same thing for purple loosestrife. There was a, I don't remember if it was a weevil or a beetle, but same thing. So there was another critter that would come in and eat it. And that was fairly successful too. Now, started on South Lake Leelanau. Glen Lake is, I believe, starting to implement it this year. They're doing some experiments with burlap to smother EWM beds.
Okay.
To see if we can use that as a control. There's always, you can, during certain times of the year, you can dive and manually remove EWM if it's small enough. But a lot of these are, you know, a lot of these patches are acres, 10, 11, 12, 14 acres. So doing it, if you can find it right away or you can find a small enough patch, scuba and manual removal is somewhat viable. But for these bigger patches, you know, they're trying to find another method. So there's, in South Lake Leelanau, the results have been fairly promising. Promising enough that Glen Lake is looking to try to do some of that this year as well. So fingers crossed. And it's labor intensive, right? I mean, you still have to send a diver down. You're still having, you know, you still have a couple people down there working on the bottom for installation. You've got to install the mats in the spring. You've got to remove them in the fall. So there's definitely some continued manual effort there. But a lot of these weed treatments, I was talking to one lake association the other day, and it's almost $20,000 for 1 year treatment.
Mm.
So it's cost prohibitive. We're seeing some potentially negative ecological reactions. So to find something that's biological, that even though it might be a little bit more labor intensive, is sustainable and effective would be tremendous.
I just remember in one of my biology or environmental science class, actually it was, they talked about how, like, early on rats ended up on an island
yeah. that
they weren't supposed to be on, and they were causing lots of problems, and obviously it came off of a wooden ship. Mm-hmm. This has got to be the 1700s or yep. something. And so then they introduced some creature to hunt the rats.
Yep.
I can't remember what it was. Maybe it was a ferret. And then the ferret got out of control. And so they introduced a creature that hunts the ferrets. And then it was just like this kind of endless litany of yep. like, every time we try to make things better, it's a sideways
yeah,
jump.
Yeah, it creates
best.
A paradigm shift and off you go.
So,
yeah.
like, I love the idea of biological solutions where it's like, let's just introduce something that only eats mm-hmm. this mussel. Wouldn't that be great? But
it doesn't always work, right? You know, and like we were talking about earlier, round goby are a native predator of both zebra and quagga mussels. But especially in Lake Michigan, the situation, there was so much available habitat, the niche was so big for those resented mussels to come in that goby can't keep up with them.
Mm-hmm.
In inland lakes, you know, we get lake associations that want us to introduce like red ear sunfish. So we don't have red ears in Michigan, but down south, they call them shellcrackers. And a lot of our panfish will eat mussels to some degree. But zebras and quaggas have a much tougher shell than a lot of our native snails and mussels.
Mm-hmm.
So for our pumpkin seeds or bluegills or green sunfish to consume them, it's a lot tougher. So we talk with lake associations, you know, oh, let's stock red ears. And we don't want to go down that road.
How much do you feel like you can predict, like parasites, for example, that this fish is fine with because they've co-evolved? But
oh yeah, and we have a lot of that. You know, I think about things like yellow grub that you see in predominantly yellow perch or black spot. You know, every panfish, walleye, pike, the, you know, minnows sometimes will have black spot. You know, those are two things that are, they can be pretty cyclical. Typically, if it's been hot, you'll see a larger outbreak of them, or they're on fish that tend to feed at the bottom quite a bit in darker, more organic sediments. Those are a couple of things. Tapeworms, you know, we see tapeworms. Lake trout, Lake Michigan have tapeworms. They're feeding on the bottom. Smallmouth and largemouth in a lot of inland lakes have tapeworms. Again, you know, they're feeding on fish certainly, but they're also spending some time pretty close to the bottom. So those are all kinds of things that fish have kind of co-evolved with for years and years. They have them. They're part of the life cycle of that particular critter. Doesn't usually kill the fish. Sometimes if the infestation is bad, it can certainly reduce the condition factor of the fish. But for the most part, that fish is just the host and everybody's happy. Except for the angler that's going to harvest it. They're not so happy.
That's a little... Make sure to cook your fish, folks.
Yeah. No sushi in Michigan fish. No eating of raw fish here.
We do plenty of that. I'd like to ask a question. It's amazing to talk to you, by the way. Okay. If you're interested in fish in this part of the world at all, this is just a litany of information that is so cool. The cohos in Crystal Lake.
Yeah.
Can you give us some idea of that situation and how it happened and what it means? And
do you know we have them in Glen too?
Oh boy. Cat's out of the bag.
Yeah,
now
sorry,
people
sorry.
Are now starting their pickups with a boat on it. Yeah, heading to Glen Lake.
Yeah. The population in Glen is I feel much smaller than Crystal is much more consistent. But yeah, so coho in their native range are tributary spawners. So this is a puddle for them, essentially, right? Like Michigan's a puddle. When Chinook want to spawn, they enter a river system when they're pretty close to being ready. They swim upstream, they find where they want to be in the main stem, spawn, do their thing, that's the end. Coho, on the other hand, out west are used to swimming thousands of miles to find the tiniest little tributary or headwater stream that they possibly can. And they kind of try to do that here too, which is good in the sense that it creates some natural reproduction. Because we've got some really small tributary streams to a lot of these river systems that are super cold and can house a Chinook or a coho salmon for a year and a half. And that's kind of the case with Crystal. So again, the outlet. Coho historically have gone up the Betsy. We see a few of them get caught in the Betsy every year. Not a ton. Like I said, way more suited to Chinook reproduction than something that needs to be super, super cold. They go up the Crystal Lake outlet. They find themselves in Crystal Lake, and Crystal Lake has all these little tributaries. Cold Creek being the most notable. But, you know, how many times you drive around Crystal Lake and you look in somebody's yard and here's this tiny little feeder stream popping out of their yard and going, you know, there's at least a dozen of them. And that's all a coho needs.
Okay.
It just needs to be able to squiggle with a boyfriend or girlfriend, do its thing, and get back out of there. And so that's what's happened over the years, especially in Cold Creek.
So these cohos that are using the inflow in the basin,
yep,
they enter the little creek and they perish.
Yeah, yeah.
Where are they?
So they won't necessarily die in the creek.
Ah.
You know, I mean, sometimes they will.
But they're going to die.
Yeah.
In their three-year, whatever their cycle is.
So Chinook have a 4-year life cycle, coho have a 3-year life cycle, and they are single time spawners. So once they go up and spawn, once their reproductive mission is complete, that's the end of their life cycle.
But people who traipse these creeks, we're not finding carcasses.
No. And sometimes, like in Crystal, those fish are probably going to go back out to the lake
and die there.
Yeah, it's just not enough water, especially in those yard creeks, if you will. Wouldn't entirely surprise me if you took a big long walk up Cold Creek in December, if you didn't find some carcasses. And that's the thing, especially with wild coho, is they tend to spawn a lot later. So those fish, for them to spawn in October, November, December, that's pretty normal. Pretty par for
So you have a self-sustaining population of coho that when the outlet was high enough, which is just recently, like last fall, it was 100 feet away.
Yep.
So the fish are now in their own ecosystem, reproducing on their own.
Yep.
So after that first generation of coho made their way into Crystal and up into these tiny tributaries and laid eggs, those offspring would have primarily stayed in Crystal Lake?
Most likely,
okay.
Yeah.
So,
if you're a fish, the outlet is tough to get out of.
Sure.
It's not necessarily always hard to get over, but it's tough to get out of a lot of times.
Interesting.
And we've had replenishment over years. I highly doubt that this came from one run of coho into the lake. You know, it's probably, there's, in years of high water in the fall, there's probably been some replenishment. And so, which is good from a genetic standpoint. But yeah, the fish that are in the lake are pretty much creating that fishery.
And they're just having their 3-year cycle without ever leaving Crystal. That's cool.
And you can see it too. I mean, the fish that we catch in Crystal, we troll Crystal for rainbows and lakers and coho. And the fish that you catch as adults in Crystal are much smaller than what you'd see out in Lake Michigan. It's the goldfish in the bowl, right? You're a product of your environment. So you're not going to get huge, especially when you've got for a coho, it's a 3-year life cycle, but you spend a year and a half in your natal stream or in a hatchery. And then you spend a year and a half out in your open body of water growing. So if you got a year and a half to get real big in Crystal Lake, certainly there's, you know, we have really good forage base in Crystal, but you've only got a year and a half to get that big and you don't have alewife, which are, you know, very, very calorie dense. So you're not growing as big as you would out in Lake Michigan.
I see.
It's a little better for you if you're a steelhead or a rainbow trout or a lake trout in Crystal where you've got 5, 6, 10, if you're a lake trout, years to get to size. So
it would be easy to say that the coho population that's self-sustaining in Crystal Lake is quite unique.
Yeah.
Can you think of any place else in this district where that's...
Just Glen.
Sort of has its own genesis.
Yeah, just Glen. And like I said, I mean, Glen, I don't feel like the population in Glen is as fishable. It's every once in a while people come across them is kind of how it works. Whereas encountering them on a Crystal is, and on Crystal, you can target them during certain times of the year. So
let's say there's a report of a new species in a body of water that has never been there before.
Yep.
Do you immediately assess whether or not that population is at risk? And possibly make rules about not keeping them?
Depends on what it is. And it depends on the body of water. So let's say we go into a lake that is a trout lake. So let's say it's something that it doesn't really have a connection anywhere, is deep and cold, not super productive. Or maybe it does have a tributary stream or two coming in. And so there's always been a resident population of trout. Maybe we supplement it with a little stocking, and all of a sudden there's a bunch of pike or there's a bunch of walleye. Come to a reasonable conclusion that some bootleg biologist decided it would be a good idea to move those fish over there.
Bootleg biologist.
That's
a pretty gentle term.
Yeah. So in that case, we would encourage anglers to harvest those predatory fish.
I see.
We might go in and do a netting effort. We're not big fans of going in and doing a netting effort for removal. We might. Depends on the situation. But we would subsequently try to do some follow-up surveys to look at the response of the trout. Especially if that population, you know, really... If you go in and do a netting survey and you catch one or two, typically everybody kind of wants to move walleye around, and what we find is when they've moved walleye around to a lake that really isn't suitable for them, they don't do very well. So they like when we catch them in our nets, their condition factor is pretty poor. They're all head. They look kind of snaky. Not a lot of meat on them. You know, low productivity lake just isn't really great if you're a walleye or a pike. So they just don't ever take off. But there are some instances where they could probably take off. And even if they don't take off, they might do damage, you know, to a cisco population, to a whitefish population, to a trout population, before they run their course. So they're a little bit longer lived species.
But is this answer predicated on the scenario where it's obvious that those fish shouldn't be there?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now, so we have had, I'm not going to name the lake because we're still looking into things, but
Nunya Creek.
Nunya Creek. Nunya Lake. I did recently have a lake, and recently, probably 4 years ago now, where someone caught some Cisco.
Mm-hmm.
And this lake is pretty well undeveloped. A lot of state land around it. We had no records of Cisco being in there prior. Part of that is probably because it's undeveloped and not a lot of people fish it. Could those fish have moved from another system? Yes. Doubtful. But so when it comes to non-game species, we kind of have to rely on soft funding if we want to do some targeted work on those. So we recently, in the past, 10 years or so, have gotten some funding to work on native species that are of like a threatened or critical status, including inland Cisco. So as part of our wildlife action plan, we've been developing a management plan for Cisco, which includes a protocol for survey efforts. In order to sample, like when we just go in and do a general netting survey in a lake, we're not doing a very good job of targeting those very, very cold water species. We only get a chance to do those lake surveys every now and then. And so we're going to go in and we're going to set nets typically this time of year, late May, June, because we want to catch a little of everything. We don't want to catch a lot of one thing necessarily in a broader survey. We want to catch a little of everything. We want panfish. We want some walleye. We want some bass. We want a little of everything. Those very cold water species like Cisco, trout, we have to do targeted efforts for them. Mm. And we want to make sure we're doing them consistently so we have some level for comparison, some basis for comparison. So we've, like I said, we've gotten some money to do that. We're working on this wildlife action plan, developing a plan for Cisco. And so we're starting to look at some of these inland Cisco lakes because we're starting to see a few of them disappear off the radar, particularly in southern Lake Michigan or southern Michigan, where the warming trends have been a little bit more severe. So for us to discover a water body that has them, we're definitely paying attention to that one. But there again, it's a low productivity lake. There's not a lot of competing species in there. It's mostly panfish, some perch, few bass. Doesn't get a ton of pressure. It's not easily accessible. So we haven't really put the focus on it or had to do anything to protect it because it's fairly well protected just given its circumstance.
Sure. Okay. Just keep an eye on
it
for now.
Yep.
I had a question about the species of rainbows that are in Crystal Lake and their genetic genesis and what strain are they and why?
Okay. So we have two. There are two strains of rainbow trout in Crystal Lake. So there's steelhead do have the potential to get into Crystal Lake through the outlet, again, especially in a high water spring. So they can get in there on their own. But DNR Fish Division stocks Eagle Lake strain rainbows, and we stock Michigan strain steelhead. So those are the two that are in there. It used to be for a long time we only stocked Eagle Lake strain rainbows. And Eagle Lakes are a domesticated strain of rainbows that we raise in our hatchery system here in Michigan. They are fairly quick growing. They are, when you catch them, they're pretty trouty looking. Even when they're in their chrome color phase, they typically will have a rounder head to them, a little bit shorter body. The growth is different on an Eagle Lake versus a Michigan strain steelhead. They typically have more spotting. In the fall, when they get colored up, the difference really pops out. But you can see it in the summertime during the chrome phase too. So we stocked those for a long, long time. And they're a good fish. They grow well. They survive well. They're easy to rear in a hatchery system. They're kind of tried and true. Steelhead, we did a great study. One of our former research biologists, Andy Newfer, did a great study in the early 2000s, 2002 through I think about 2005, where he took these larger lakes, Crystal Lake included, Crystal, Glen, Elk, a number of lakes on the other side of the state too, Walloon, and we did a paired comparison study. So we stocked an equal amount of Eagle Lakes and an equal amount of steelhead. They were each given a unique fin clip. We did creel, we did netting surveys, we did electrofishing surveys, and looked at survival. So we talked to anglers and looked at their catch. We saw, you know, catches in our netting gear and our electrofishing gear. And hands down, in every one of those systems, except for Walloon was okay, except for Elk, nothing survived. We couldn't find anything. We couldn't find any of the rainbows, so we ended up cutting that program and replacing them with browns. But in lakes like Crystal and Glen, everywhere that we had good survival, the steelhead outperformed the Eagle Lake strain, hands down. So we've tried to raise more steelhead through the years. Steelhead are in a hatchery system for a year and a half. We have to rear them at a certain density in order to keep them happy and healthy. And so what that means is we have limited hatchery space we can raise them. We raise them at Thompson Hatchery in the UP, and we raise them at Wolf Lake down by Kalamazoo, Mattawan area. And so we're quite limited. Everybody wants steelhead. They're a fantastic game fish. They provide a lake fishery. They provide a stream fishery for an extended length of time. They're multiple year spawners. So there's a lot of value to anglers in steelhead, myself included. And so because we can only produce a limited amount of them, we haven't always been able to rear enough for these inland lake systems in addition to our river systems. But I've got a lot of guys that fish for them on Crystal, and so I get a lot of angler reports, which is huge because that helps me justify getting those fish. So angler reports from Crystal are always welcome. I don't contribute those to like the fishing report. I don't put them online. Your secrets are all safe with me. They go hidden in my file. And I use it as ammunition when it comes time to fight for some increased stocking. But I've been able to consistently stock steelhead in Crystal Lake, man, for I think the past 5 or 6 years. When we do steelhead, we grade them in the fall, so we get shorts. The bigger fish in the fall get put through to raise in the hatchery system. The shorts they offer up to people, I will take shorts and put them in Crystal because I know they do well there. We also stock bigger spring fish. So this spring in Crystal, we got, off the top of my head, we got 23,000 Eagle Lake strain rainbows in Crystal, and we got just shy of 8,000 steelhead in Crystal. I was hoping for more in Crystal, and we might still, actually that might not be complete because I think we got extras that aren't in the stocking database right now. So we may have gotten an extra 5 or 10,000 steelhead for Crystal. So I try to do it 50-50. I try to have about 20 and 20. Not always the case. But I try to get as many steelhead in Crystal as I can because they do so well. You know, they create that fantastic beach fishery on the Beulah side. You can troll for them in the open water, you know, whenever there's open water. We do see them recruit to the ice fish fishery a little bit when we've got ice. But they're a super versatile fish that you can spend all the money in the world and have a boat and go catch them, or you can spend hardly any money at all and sit on the beach and have a great time utilizing them. So super universal fish, but that's the two strains we have in Crystal, Eagle Lake and Michigan strain steelhead.
Where do you put them in the lake?
Right at Cold Creek.
You put them in at the creek mouth.
Yep.
So they...
It's an easy stocking location. It's access to cold water and refuge. And if they hang around there and if they're not done smolting and they imprint on that Cold Creek water, they're inclined to go up Cold Creek and spawn, hopefully.
Yeah.
Wonderful. At least the steelhead.
Yeah.
Is the goal at some point to have this be a self-sustaining pair of populations, or is it likely you'll just always have to supplement it?
It's likely we'd always have to supplement it. For as big as Crystal Lake is, the amount of fish that it can support, the tributaries are kind of lacking for spawning habitat. So every stream out there has what we call, and a lake too, but for the sake of spawning, every stream out there has a carrying capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And just based on the landscape, based on flow and food availability, temperature, that stream is limited in how many smolts or juvenile fish it can output. You know, you could put 10,000 pair in there and it's still going to output the same amount of fry as if you had 2,000 pair in there.
Ah.
It's just, there's a limiting factor that limits the output of a system.
Biomass.
It's hugely important. So, you know, with Cold Creek being the primary, it's a short tributary system. It's got a bunch of branches, which is cool. That gives it some additional length. But some of those branches have some pockets of warm just because they were dredged for agriculture. Still capable of producing fish. We see browns, we see brook trout, the coho, some steelhead. And those seeps or those spring-fed systems that are coming out of people's yards, same thing. Could a couple pair spawn successfully in there? Yeah. Is it going to be enough fish to really maintain the population that we see being utilized out in Crystal Lake? No. Nope.
All right. Well, we aren't fully out of time, but I do have to outro us at some point here. I don't know if Matt's coming. Normally, we have a Matt Nonson who does a music show after my show, but maybe he's scheduled somewhere else now or something. But anyway, so 6 minutes to go here. Any final thoughts? Messages for the people? Oh.
Speak of the devil. No, I would just encourage people, like I said, I'm not into blowing up secrets, but because we talked earlier in the segment that I don't have a ton of staff. There's, you know, 7 or 8 of us really that work in a 27 county area. I rely pretty heavily on anecdotal information. Mm-hmm. So I like having conversations like this. I like having anglers call and ask questions and talk through things and send me observations, whether it's sturgeon, whether it's patterns they're seeing with brown trout in a stream, whatever the case may be. Fish kills, we like having those reported. Do I give out fishing information? Sure. But I try to be informative, but I try to guard people's honey holes and stuff like that. So that anecdotal information is huge and goes a long way in helping me make decisions about where we survey, what we look at. And like I said, helps me kind of defend getting fish for stocking and that sort of thing. So I a big part of my job is talking to anglers and I welcome any comments, questions, concerns at any point in time.
All right. Oh, yeah. So if people want to contact you.
Yeah. So two ways. Easiest way is probably email. This time of year, especially, I'm out in the field a ton, so I don't always answer the desk phone. But my email is hettingerh@michigan.gov, hettingerh@michigan.gov. And then my phone is 231-922-6056. Like I said, I live here in Benzie County, but I work out of the Traverse City office up at Chum's Corner. So I can usually be found around the hatchery or up there. Either way, leave me an email, leave me a voicemail, and I'll touch base with you.
All right. Thank you very much, Heather.
Yeah, thanks for having me.